Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is the internationally known artist, sculptor, urban designer, John David Mooney. We're talking with John David Mooney from his, is this your studio in Chicago, John David?
It is, Steve, and thank you for calling. I think this is quite an honor.
Well, good to be talking to you. For listeners who may not be familiar with your work, let's talk a little bit about some of the fascinating places you have placed sculptures. Why don't we start with, maybe going back to the Olympics in Atlanta. That was really an amazing piece.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Star Dance, it was called. And it was a commission for Atlanta to be the icon of the Games, which is an amazing thing. You don't find many venues that the Olympics are held in that they wanted a visual image as the major magnet and point of impact.
A major work of art.
It turned out to be that. Those games were done differently, too, than prior games with no government money. It was all corporate and private funding and individuals that supported the games. So they had to go to multiple sponsors, and which we, which to which I to whom I was presented. Some weren't too thrilled about my art at all. Didn't want anything to do with it. But Bell South, who had the major high rise on Peachtree Street and across from the Natorium, which was a of course, a major venue. Filming is key to these games, and they said that they would like to be the sponsors of the major icon work. And we did it by transforming their building into a light sculpture with 32 pencil thin xenon beams in the air on a four-hour program, which I wrote the score for, a visual score, but it looks like a musical composition, page after page of the movement of each one of these pieces, each piece standing for a searchlight, how many degrees it would move in a radial position, how long it would take to do that, and how many degrees of the next one or that same one, if in sequence, would move in an azimuth position. So it was all about time, the time arts, really. A performance piece that went 8 miles in the sky, besides a transformation of the building, and the attraction was major in the fact that all the news media from around the world. We just had, as you might know, at the NATO conference, which was so successful, that Mayor Emanuel hosted here in Chicago with President Obama. And, of course, we had a press corps from around the world. Well, that same type of press corps was present in Atlanta, but they were doing live television broadcasts every night, and they used Star Dance as a backdrop. So you could be circling on a wide swath around Atlanta, and you would see a film crew in many languages, almost like today, Pentecost, in multiple languages, giving their news, and Star Dance was in the background.
Now, you've also done major pieces. For example, I know of the one in the University of Chicago Library that's made of Waterford crystal and aluminum. Tell listeners how that came about.
Well, thank thank you. The Cristara, that piece is called, and it is made of aluminum, not only welded and hand rubbed, but that aluminum serves as a sculptural image which holds horizontally 12-foot-length columns of Waterford crystal, which I designed. Waterford kind of reminds you of the sherry glass your aunt might drink out of, with a 17th century cut. This, however, I took the strength of Waterford. It has more red lead in it than any other crystal, so it's very, very strong, and it has a refractive quality to it that no other crystal has, so it can break down the spectrum. And I tried to figure out how to make this. Didn't have a clue, to be honest. How do you take a 12th century technology that you blow glass and you still do it in the old way in a wooden form, you know, and in a furnace, and you and the biggest vessel that we could blow was 15 inches, and I needed 12 feet, but I just kept going, figuring something's going to happen. I'm not too sure how I'm going to do this, and as I was leaving for Waterford, Ireland, to investigate how I would do it, I found that Loctite had just invented a curing adhesive glue that's absolutely clear as the crystal itself, stronger than the crystal when it's found, and it was invented by a Dublin chemist, and Loctite had just bought this patent from these inventors in Ireland. So I tested it, and we put the blanks of the crystal in the hexagonal and octagonal shapes that I was using, and there is no way that we could break the bind, and so they allowed me to start working in that mode, and then I got it all pretty much worked out, and they had to close the plant for a month. The major blowers, the major cutters worked on this piece for 1 month. They were still making their line of hand-blown crystal glasses, but not the not the major artisans who gave it the capability of the strength that it had. And interestingly, as long as it is in under the skylight at the John Cuellar Library at the University of Chicago, it gets stronger every day and holds more because this particular glue is strengthened by more UV light that hits it. And it also changed the industry. I don't think for the better, but now Waterford and Orifice and many other companies use this glue in creating shapes that they could never make before. So it moved this 12th century industry forward a little bit. So that's good. It was a great commission that came from the chairman, the board of chairman of the board of trustees of the University of Chicago, who held two hats. He was also chairman of the board of the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago. So I don't know which one he thought he was really operating on when he commissioned this work, but the university was behind it 100%, and I worked with the committee on social thought and meeting with them continuously. In fact, they're the group that named it, and Hannah Gray, president, one morning we found a note at 5 o'clock in the morning attached to the sculpture. She'd already walked through the library, which she did every morning to see the progress. And we had Cristallis as the name for the sculpture, and she said, "This will not do. This is a ninth century Latin derivative. It is not pure Latin. It won't work. Come up with another one. So we still created a new name that didn't exist, Christara, which she bought, and so it was fun.
For listeners who have not had the opportunity to see this sculptor that's suspended almost magically in this atrium in the library, it's worth a trip to Hyde Park to see. We're talking with John David Mooney, who is an artist, a sculptor, creates often very, very large major urban pieces, such as the one we were mentioning earlier that was part of the Atlantic Olympic Games called Star Dance, a light sculpture. This program is a live program, and listeners can call in with comments or questions, can talk to the artist we're talking with tonight. So if you'd like to do that anywhere the program is heard in the continental U.S., you may punch in a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana, Illinois listening area, in area code 217, you may get our studio by punching in local number 333-9455. And our technical director, Kyle Crow, will answer the phone and put you in line to talk with our artist guest, John David Mooney. His last name is spelled M-O-O-N-E-Y, John David Mooney.
Steve, pick up on what you said about the suspension of Christara,
yes,
in this library. It does occupy the room of three floors, and it was designed to be able to walk underneath and to be a totally different piece as you walked around it on each of the top two floors of the library, the top three, I guess, is a four-story building. And so it doesn't look the same anyplace, and it is magically suspended. An architect who has been an intern in my studio did the engineering for that, Aki Knezovich. They're invisible stainless steel wires that hold this in place, and it's strung, so it moves with the building as all buildings move, and as it contracts and expands, the piece is like in a cradle, and it does the same thing. And so we took it beyond what is possible, and of course the search for engineers to stamp those drawings was long and hard. But there was the only way to do it.
We've titled this program Physics Meets the Arts because, as we've heard already, John David Mooney has had to learn some new things in terms of physics and architecture and structure, and as we'll hear later, about botany for one of the pieces he recently did for the city of Urbana, Illinois. Particularly physics. Your pieces are so large that they do require engineering and architecture and structural engineers, I guess, to be involved. Tell us how you got into this whole type of art. Tell us a little bit about your early history.
Well, you know, in my high school education at Champaign High School, I had a physics teacher, Nellie Bates. And there are six guys in that class. All of us are still friends. We did that for 2 years, and we made experiment out of experiment. And physics just really deals with matter, and that's what art deals with, is matter. And it's a basic entrance. I fell in love with it then, and I think that I am drawn to the nature of things, and whether they're in motion or in stationary, and to see what can happen. I was teaching at the University of Notre Dame, and I find that there's only one reason to be at a university, and that's to explore what the other departments are doing. I knew what I was about, and so I needed to find some interest and inspiration, and I found some postdocs working in the radiation laboratory and in the high-energy physics divisions and PhD candidates, and I began to see experiments in plasma excited gases. And the colors were fantastic. Well, if you're dealing with the five rarefied gases, you're getting the colors of the whole spectrum as if you were in outer space, so it's almost the time of creation. And before light and dust and everything else changes that, the light is as we see it. And everything moves in waves, and these patterns of excited gases, as they relax, become bright. And so this happens in a what they call an open system with vacuum pumps running. And so it's really quite hypnotic to see these disks of light crossing over each other. And I was able to blow these up to a really large scale so that you go into a semi-darkened room and the scale of this light was amazing and hypnotic and a beautiful hue. The need that I needed to do was put it in a closed system so that there would be no vacuum pumps and the boom, boom, boom and the breathing sound of everything that these pumps make in an open system. And I was able to do that through lots of experimentation. And instead of a pallet full of paint and brushes and paint knives, I had a mixing pallet of glass vessels, all the different gases, and mixed them together to get the different hues I wanted, and was able to seal these off with the electrodes at the ends of again, specially blown glass vessels. And so with the facilities of that university, and I went on to become artist in residence at Purdue University in all of the colleges of engineering, and so I was able to use their resources, too, within that area. And one piece is in the lobby in West Lafayette called Ball Floor. It's in it's the entrance piece to the engineering building and the engineering library on Purdue University's campus. It's part of that early phase of experimentation when I was a baby artist.
Tell me, when you knew you were going to pursue art.
When?
When?
Oh.
How early in your life?
4 years old.
Really?
Without question. I knew then and there. In Champaign-Urbana, there were many great painters, many great artists, but there was one, Louise Woodruff, who invited me at that age into her studio, and I saw I think I fell in love with the studio, actually, with the racks of paintings and the entire atmosphere of creation within that space, and I liked her paintings. And I think that from then on, it just continued, and I got more and more opportunity to explore and to paint.
What was your schooling beyond Champaign High School?
I went to the University of Notre Dame, and I came back to the University of Illinois and got a Master of Fine Arts. I'd actually gone on to the Brooklyn Museum, the Max Beckmann Fellowship, which was a big deal at the time. Only one is awarded in the country. And after about 6 weeks, I realized that I had turned down all the fellowships at all the university graduate schools in order to take this up, and I didn't have any money, and Manhattan was expensive. and I thought, okay, what do I want to do? Do I want to teach? And I said yes, and so I better have an MFA, which is a terminal degree in the fine arts. And I called up the University of Illinois and said, look, can I pick up my fellowship? It was November then, They said, yeah, if you're here within 10 days, you got it back. And so there was a closed circle. And when I was a child, I would bicycle over to the university's fine arts building, it was the fine and applied arts and housed architecture also, and the fine arts studios were on the top floor with Beaux-Arts north-facing windows. It was lovely, and I would spend Saturdays painting the still lifes that were set up for the college students when I was in third and fourth and fifth grade. And then the University of Illinois did something else, which was a real gift. They had a thing that nobody is doing, probably because of expense and insurance. But they had a survey of American painting and sculpture. And the paintings were the top pieces being made in the country. And they did this every 2 years. It was a biannual. And they hung on the wall. There was no fancy museum like Cranach today. They hung on the walls and ends of the architecture gallery. And a lot of it was wet. Hans Hofmann's painting was maybe still slipping off the canvas that was hanging there. And to be able to see and explore the newest and the best in art every day simply by riding a bicycle across town on my own was the superior chance of a lifetime that really probably did cement my desire as a child to be an artist.
Let me reintroduce our guest today on Keeping the Faith. We're talking with John David Mooney, M-O-O-N-E-Y, from his studio in Chicago. He's kindly given us a whole hour of his time on this Sunday evening to talk about art, and particularly in relation to physics and other sciences. He's the creator of a new piece that's just been installed last month near the City Hall of Urbana, Illinois. But he has created sculptures around the world. We'll be talking with him about the Urbana piece, as well as several others, as well as his foundation, which has been in existence since the early 70s, where people, artists, have come together. They have an apprentice, an internship program that talks about ideals of service and the collaborative processes that inspire good art. So we'll be talking about some of those ethical issues in just a few minutes. If listeners have a question or would like to make a comment about something we're discussing, join the conversation. 333-9455 is a local Champaign-Urbana, Illinois number. If you're outside the 217 area code, there's a toll-free number you may use to call, 1-800-222-9455. We're about halfway through our program this evening. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs here on WILL. This is being broadcast live at 580 AM as well as simultaneously at 90.9 FM HD3 from Urbana, Illinois. Also, of course, listeners may be listening live at will.illinois.com. .edu/AM. And if you missed part of this program, you may hear it at that same website at your convenience after a week or two. It'll be up maybe even after 2 or 3 days on that website. Just go to will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith and leave the G off of keeping. We're very informal here. You'll be able to punch in the search engine John David Mooney or look for this date. And you can hear this program at your convenience on any number of devices. Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith here on WILL, I will be traveling for several weeks, and Professor Don Nolan will be our guest host. Next week he'll be talking with two folks from CASA, dealing with people who are advocates for children at risk. This is the... Of course, court-appointed Special Advocate Program. And Rush Record and Elizabeth Buckley will be Don's guest. That's June 3rd here on Keeping the Faith, next Sunday night at 5 o'clock. On June 10, Bruce Carmazon from the Lumpkin Foundation will be here talking about the Child Development Center in Uganda in Africa. And two program series, really, on Africa. On June 17, Don Nolan will also be talking with Carl Birkebeil and Lynn Warfel about caring for Kenya, dealing particularly with problems in that African country. Ron Sider will be my guest. I will be back June 24th talking about his newest book, Fixing the Moral Deficit. Ron Sider has written a very good book looking at the U.S. national budget. Those are some of the programs coming ahead on Keeping the Faith, but now let's get back to our guest, John David Mooney, and we have a couple callers waiting to ask a question or make a comment. Let's go to line number one. You're on the air.
Hi, hello.
Yes.
When I think of public art, I suppose it's quite expensive, and I'm wondering what positive effects do you sense that public art has on the community that would sort of justify its expense and its effort?
John David, could you hear?
I could hear. What's the justification of public art? Interestingly, today is Pentecost in the Jewish faith and in the Christian tradition. 50 days after Passover, 50 days after Easter, and it's a tradition of giving. It's a really probably one of the major celebrations in both religions. What has been given to us, and then what we give back. Art is not much different than that. It's an act of giving. It is an act of hoping, and this doesn't always work, and it, of course, has the right of rejection, but there is a hope that there is an aesthetic moment in the viewer's eyes that can give them pleasure, some possibly meditation, some other component that is something that they wouldn't get in the normal rush of the secular day. It's special. It may be a piece of architecture. It may be a painting. It may be a sculpture. It may be urban planning. It may be the way the streets are designed with the visual closures. It's the beauty of all of those and many more components that can enhance the life of the city dweller, of the viewer, and of the guest. This afternoon I was giving a tour of some of the major public sculptures in Chicago, and I began with the Dubuffet, and I should say, to whom this tour was. It's the young people who were coming to Chicago as pilgrims on a Taizé retreat, international. I had six people with me from Germany, from Quebec, from Montreal, from Naples, Florida, from all parts. They wanted... in the spiritual retreat of which they were attending, the only tourism that they were interested in was the public art in Chicago. In the walk, they began to see that our architecture is public art too, and not only is it invention, but it's also art. And then they began with all the French pieces, the Dubuffet in front of the State of Illinois building, and then the Picasso, and the Miro, and then the Marc Chagall, which is across from Inland Steel, and the Leopold, and the Inland Steel lobby, and the Alexander Calder, and the Federal Plaza. And when Mies van der Rohe designed those three buildings of the Federal Plaza, the post office, the office building, the Dirksen building, the office building, and the courts, he was all about proportion, and some of them couldn't quite see where these big brown boxes were art. But then they realized that it was based upon geometry and the beauty of that mathematical relationship, and they saw something new within that. Before he went into the Art Institute, and then saw another transformation, and that is Marc Chagall's windows that he gave to the city of Chicago, the stained glass windows. And so they saw both the mosaic piece and the stained glass. They saw that transcendence. And it was all part of their spiritual retreat, their journey to Chicago on a day which is about giving and about journey. And that might be some aspect of why public art is good. It, believe me, it takes a lot out of everybody involved, particularly all the community that gets involved in it. And because it is normally a new shape, a new form, something that hasn't existed before, that is going to arrest the mind, or maybe, and hopefully, give some pleasure, but mind might be disturbed too. Especially if it's good art, it might disturb even more on first encounter and let you come back again and again to come to an understanding.
I remember the furor when the Picasso's public sculpture was given to Chicago when it was first put up. We have another caller waiting. Let's go to line number two. You're on the air with our guest today, John David Mooney. Yes, line two.
Good afternoon. I wanted to ask a personal question, perhaps one difficult to answer other than that's just what I like. I started thinking about the scale of work that you do and the scale of an awful lot of sculpture and structural creation, things from what you can hold in your hand and look at and experience, what you can put in your home, things that would go outside or in a 3 or 4 story atrium. And finally, when you talked about a sculpture that you literally had to appreciate by walking around, you couldn't just stand still and crane your head and get a feel for it by how much your neck moved and your eyes had to move. So the question becomes, what drew you to this scale of work? There's so many layers and levels, all of which require certain amount of technique and physics, if you want. But yours winds up with an awful lot of physics, but I don't think you did it just to enjoy the physics of keeping things up and together. You were drawn to this scale for a reason, and I'm hoping you could just explore that thought for a while. Why attracted to this size work? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. John David?
Very good question. One that probably has not been put so well in that form. I think it's because of the human scale itself and the multiplication of that scale. And we measure things against our own reach. We have a foot. We have a yard. Which is an arm's length. We have an inch, which is a bit of a thumb finger. We've always kind of measured in terms of the human condition, and then of course Leonardo da Vinci, in his Codex, made that proportion to be fit into the realm of sacred geometry and the proportions. Of his ideal man. And so I think it's about multiplication and an urban environment is one that requires that. In terms of how you move through a city and how you stop, and that's probably the scale, but to be really honest, how I began doing it was a commission that I received from the School of Architecture and the University Faculty Club at the University of Notre Dame on my very first semester teaching there as a professor. And I'm coming back as a student of Ivan Mestrovich, the sculptor who you may know of, particularly because of his Indians on Horseback, without the arrow, at the Conga Street Bridge and Michigan Avenue.
In Chicago, yes, the one holding the invisible arrow or bow and the one holding the invisible spear.
That's exactly right, and it's been broadcast in this last week with NATO protesters all over the world.
Yes.
He did that as a young man. He's 25 years old. And I became his student at the end of his life. In fact, he croaked in my in the drawing studio on a Saturday morning. In those days, we had Saturday classes, and so did the professors. And it was sad. I kind of wanted my money back too because I was only a sophomore, but I didn't get the full benefit. But I did get it from observation of his work, and he too was able to work from a small object to a large object, an object which is monumental in scale, such as those Indians on Horseback. He was only 25 when he did those. The commission, by the way, artists are always a little bit of a rebel. Were to be soldiers on Horseback, and they were to be closer to the auditorium building on Michigan Avenue, and they were to be protecting the city from intruders, like any medieval city would have a rider on horseback. He did just the opposite. He saw how Chicago was unique. He came for a site visit, and he saw that Chicago was truly unique, and he moved those pieces much further to the east, and he's protecting nature, Grant Park and the lake in the park, from the city. And so they're a gateway to nature, a gateway to the environment. I think I learned from these different things and then have a sense of scale. Sometimes in order that scale doesn't overcome or threaten, you have to wait until the environment is correct. In the Urbana Park, I put in the trees first, which are now taller than the sculpture. Which
you're talking about the living trees, not your sculptural symbolic trees, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so the symbolic sculpture is actually nestled between these much taller growths. So there are multiple reasons for waiting, but that was certainly one of them, so that it would not violate scale. And if it were out there alone by itself, it would be a violation of the space. But with an entire park designed for it and around it, there is not that violation, I don't believe.
Let's move to conversation about the most recently dedicated sculpture work here in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. Here you are, a local boy growing up here, going to the University of Illinois as a child and learning arts, and then graduating from Champaign Central, coming back here from the high school, and then coming back here for a Master of Fine Arts, and then given this commission by the City Council of Urbana after you'd done many other large-scale works around the globe. So you had to come home and were given, I guess you were given total control of creating this whole park. It's a small park, a mini park, but rather in a very prominent place right across from a shopping center and next to the city building. What was it like to come home and be given sort of freedom, and yet things had to be approved by the council, I guess?
Well, it's no different, to be really honest, than any place else, except it took twice as long, maybe 10 times as long. It is the approval is the first thing I seek, and I seek when I do public works. I like, first of all, to bring the commissioning agent, and if that's all that's involved, if it's more than that, I want to bring the people that it'll affect. The people who really are will have ownership of the work. And I was able to do that through all these council meetings and other meetings and public lectures and discussions. And all of those meetings in Urbana or elsewhere really feed the project. They really do give me ideas. I really do respond to all of this. I don't come with a preconceived idea. And in fact, in this in Spirit Tree, the most recent installation in this Urbana Park, the final decision was Mayor Prosing's. I had down to two objects. I could have gone with either of these, and we would have been okay. She took the better of the two. A good eye, and that was backed up. She also had her city officials, and all of it is on the same theme, so it was not a variation of approvals that had been given along the line. But it was a good eye that she had that ruled this particular work.
Now, this was a joint public and private project. Some money was donated privately by corporations, by individuals. Local Urbana attorney Carl Weber, was he a childhood friend of yours? But at any rate, he did a lot of the fundraising, I know, for this project. But the city also put in some money, and maybe there were other grants that I don't know about. But is that unusual that a sponsorship for a major work of art will be both public and private?
It is not unusual, but it is this is textbook case, and it would not have come about without Carl Weber. His work, for those listening, Carl was a childhood friend of mine, and that friendship has remained strong, as all my friendships have with Champaign-Urbana residents. But Carl especially was dedicated to this project. And without his perseverance and on it every day for years and years and years, it would not have come back up. I would have given up several times, I think. And I, believe me, can persevere. And Carl was
you have dealt with the, you have dealt after all with the Vatican.
Well, now that's a bureaucracy.
Yeah, another story.
To top all bureaucracies, believe me. But it takes an awful lot to pull one of these off. And Carl is the real architect of the project. I just kind of filled in the spaces, And the project also began with another friend, Mayor Jeff Markland, and Lonnie Clark, who was on the city council. And it began at that point. So we've gone through several administrations, time makes the piece better. There's more time for aging, maybe finding mistakes in some of the planting and the shrubs, and also being open to their chance of getting disease and dying out. So it's an ongoing thing. We still have a lot to do in that park. There is furniture that's very special. Two benches are made, and more granite is sitting in Urbana to be cut into a table and chairs and benches for a seating area.
So you've designed these parts of the park as well?
Yes.
Okay, and they're yet to come. Let's give a little verbal description for folks who are far away. This program is heard over the air from Chicago to Indianapolis, and there are people who have not been to Urbana to see this yet. It's very new. Let's talk about the light sculpture first.
Spirit Tree.
Yes.
The last piece that we've put in. There are two sculptures in the park. One is called Falling Leaf, which is symbolic of the of the fruit of a tree.
I don't know how sculptors and artists feel about this, but I've already heard neighborhood children referred to falling leaf as the three kisses.
Oh, how nice. Oh, that's really nice. That's very, very good. And the way in which it sits and the three units put together are very difficult, again, in engineering and in fabrication. So, in fact, it is as fragile as a kiss and has that charm to it. And then that they've interpreted it that way is a real compliment.
That's Falling Leaf, and that's in kind of a hidden part of this little park behind a mound. Talk about what you had in mind with that mound and hiding this little part.
Sure. First of all, the park space is small. It's a city lot and a half, probably not much more than that. And it uses a side entrance of the city building, which is the entrance everybody uses. But it's like a Frank Lloyd Wright entrance to one of his houses. He always gives the main entrance around to the side, small, you have to bend down to walk in, etc. So the plan, the paving plan, the circulation plan was the first part that was laid out. So you have a parking lot on two sides. And if you're doing a park, you don't want to see cars. That's number one. You're just not putting plants in as decoration. You want it structured. So the walkways from the parking lot, from the street, from the county courthouse, and from directly across the street, the parking lot and Lincoln Square, are based upon a Japanese walkway. You walk 10 feet or 5 feet in one direction, you have one visual closure. You turn and you have another visual scene and another visual scene. The interior area is a meditative area, and I was paying homage to the first settlers in this area, which were the Native Americans, the Illini Nation, and whether that's made up of the Miami or the Potawatomi in this particular case, I'm unsure. But they had as an iconic architecture ceremonial circles, and they would meet in these circles. One stands between Indianapolis and Muncie, Indiana, called Mound State Park, and it's an earthen ring, and the elders and the tribes would meet in this circle. And I had always been taken by that, and I wanted to do something to pay homage to the Native Americans, and I thought that this ring of earth would be one of those symbols. Interestingly, this ring mirrors the council ring inside the City Hall building where the aldermen sit in circular form. So there is a natural ring outside and a political structure inside the building. And we had to raise up this earth so that we'd be above the line of the automobile. So from wherever you were, you felt safe and secure from the vision of more parking lots. What a compliment to the city that they gave up all this space, which normally they would be clamoring for as parking space. And that is a real, real gesture. Mayor Daley once asked me what he thought Block 37 should be turned into, and that's a block across the street from Marshall Field, now Macy's, and the Federal Center, and the Picasso. And I said, a park. And he said, I knew you would say that. they had trouble for 25 years making a development in that space. Now there is a building, but it's still trouble.
Now, the park in Urbana where Spirit Tree is and Falling Leaf, at the base of Falling Leaf is water, moving water. Tell us about that idea.
You need a fountain sculpture. The piece came about really because Mrs. Weber was encouraging a fountain, Carl's mother. She liked a fountain. I had a golden rain tree actually planned for that space to give shade to be sitting underneath it. And so to do a fountain, you want it to work in the wintertime. That's key in a four-season, severe four-season environment. So I designed a sculpture that would work in the snow and that in the summer and spring and fall when they could turn on the pumps, it would also be a fountain. And the water comes slowly dripping out of the leaf or the mouth maybe of one of these units of the sculpture into a pool. There is a spiral unit in that pool, which again repeats the movement of waves, the wave formation that water takes, and I think hopefully it's a meditative piece. It's quiet. It's a surprise. There's only a few angles that you can see it from the street. So after you look at the sculpture, you go back into this much more quiet, meditative space. And it's made of mirrored, polished stainless steel. And it really is a favorite of mine. It has some similarity to Spirit Tree in the fact that it deals with as much void as form as it does mass.
Now, Spirit Tree is three stories high and is lit at night. If you were quoted correctly in the local newspaper when it was dedicated, you said you think it's ideally seen at dusk.
That's right. All light sculptures have about an hour and a half of true magic to them. And that's the hour and a half before the sunset and also before after dawn. And it's an amazing. There is a continuous change. It becomes kinetic. You don't have to do anything to the lighting. It's all done by the sun. And it really is a magic moment. I also think the daytime piece is equally strong because it's dealing with shadows, and it has therefore the capability of tracing those shadows across the ground plane. And this particular piece was designed that way, that those shadows would go into this meditative area of the park, and that it would in some way and in some seasons mimic the shape of the walkway, the granite walkway, and the pool of that whole falling leaf. So, and that's a kinetic pattern. So, again, just like all of these night and day is much more important than night because you've got 12 guaranteed hours of that. Nighttime, people give up and go to sleep. and nothing changes after darkness. So that gives some energy to that aspect of it, which I really like.
Now, there were some controversial things about this sculpture, as I'm sure there have been about many public art pieces around the world by many different artists. Originally, you had thought of using neon lights to light this, but it ended up being with LED lights. The first ones were met with some objection. Did you change because of those objections or because something new was better?
Well, it did turn out that something new was better, but it wasn't because of any objections. The LED that I had planned when I did transfer from neon to LED would have looked just like neon. They appropriate the whole image of neon. And I had been using neon for years, could not use it in this piece because that high-energy voltage continues right down to the ground. And it would short to the ground. And so it was a necessity not to use it if I kept this particular design. I had another various options which would have not brought the neon to the ground. Luckily, during this time process, this great invention by U of I professor Nick Holonyak, John Bardeen's co-inventor of the resistor, also who he invented the LED, was the technology of making it became more and more possible. And in the last year and a half, the type of LED lighting that I am using is the newest thing out, and we can do it without interruption. No other LED lighting has that capability. No other one has a low enough profile that would not be intruding into the piece. So we're really lucky, and the piece is lit both as a light sculpture with three lighting patterns, a white, blue, and then blue and white. And I think now they're used just using blue and white, which is really amazing that the piece of steel of which is receiving the light of these LEDs mixes and becomes orange and blue. So I think that's kind of appropriate for
Those who don't know, the orange and blue are the official colors of the University of Illinois. John David, we've run out of time. I'm sorry we don't have time to talk about others of your notable works, but thank you so much for talking with us for this last 58 minutes. We've been talking with John David Mooney. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith, I'll be traveling. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs, but Professor Don Nolan from Parkland College will be interviewing our guests next week. Some folks from CASA talking about being advocates for children, Rush Record, and Elizabeth Buckley. On June 10th, our guest will be Bruce Karmazin from the Lumpkin Foundation, along with Pastor Luzwato from Uganda, talking about the Child Development Center there. Following week, another program dealing with Africa, Caring for Kenya with Carl Berkebile and Lynn Warfel as Don Nolan's guest. I'll be returning for June 24 to talk with Ron Sider about his new book, Fixing the Moral Deficit. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
Join hosts Gary Sinise and Joe Mantegna for A Night of Remembrance, featuring an all-star lineup of dignitaries, actors, and musical artists in performance with the National Symphony Orchestra. The 23rd annual broadcast of the National Memorial Day Concert airs live from the West Lawn of the U.S. Capitol before a concert audience of hundreds of thousands, millions more at home, and to troops around the world. Watch the National Memorial Day Concert Sunday night at 7 on WILL-TV.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.